Started. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for Monday, March 25th. I got the date right this time. And I wanted to thank everybody for your patience. I had to go next door and testify on one of the bills that I'm a chief co-sponsor, and it happened to be the same time as this committee. But with that said, I'm going to go ahead and open up an informational meeting on update on wolf management in Oregon. I don't think we've had an update in this committee probably for several years, and so at the suggestion of Senator Hansel, who said it would be a good idea to have an update on wolf management in Oregon, we've put together some panels. I want to thank everybody who's come here today to provide information to us. We do have till about 4:30 today, so we're hoping to have plenty of time for questions. And I'm going to call up, we actually have divided this up into panels that my staff has coordinated with ahead of time. And we're going to start off with an overview from the Department of Fish and Wildlife on the wolf management program. And we also have a special guest with us today, in addition, Carter Niemeyer, who's a retired Idaho wolf recovery coordinator from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So first I'm going to call up Kurt Melcher and Bruce Eddy, Russ Morgan, all from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And Carter, if you want to come up, we have four chairs, so you can come on up with us to provide an overview for us and an update on the current status of the wolf management plan. So thank you, gentlemen.
Sure. Well, good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Director Elliker sends his regards as he is out of town this week and could not be here with you today. And I will relinquish my chair here to Mr. Niemeyer in just a moment. I just want to introduce the two staff folks that I have here, and I'm going to let them, uncharacteristically, I'm going to let them do all the talking today. So with me I have Bruce Eddy, who's the Northeast Region Manager based in LeGrand and administers our programs essentially in the entire northeast corner of the state. And then Russ Morgan, who is our first and only wolf coordinator. He's been with the wolf program here since prior to their arrival in the state, and is the primary individual that implements our wolf conservation plan, among other on-the-ground activities. So with that, with your permission,
why don't we have you and Carter switch, exactly, so you can stay up here in case you're needed. And Carter came all the way from, is it Idaho or Montana?
I live in Boise, Idaho.
Yeah, came all the way from Idaho to be here today, so we appreciate you being here as well. So, Bruce, are you going to start off with the introduction? Or
Chair Dingfelder, Deputy Melcher, I'm not going to say very much. Russ has really done all of the work for us and has led the charge basically in Northeast Region, which is where most of the wolves are right now. So I'll turn that over to Russ.
Great. And Russ, I just want to make sure you're going to give a little background on the wolf management plan. And some of the members weren't around when that started, so I'm hoping you'll start sort of way back. Otherwise, we'll have Kurt can provide that.
Senator Dingfelder, I will. I'll try to start from the beginning, certainly in the short amount of time we have, I won't be able to do too much, but I think today I can at least cover the four topics that you see here and sort of reference how those fit into our wolf plan. Oregon is fortunate, I suppose, to have an adopted wolf plan, and so today what I'll do is talk about how we monitor wolves, how many wolves we have, where they occur, and how we're doing in relation to that plan. And then, of course, a subject that many are interested in, and that is the issue of livestock depredation by wolves. With that, I'll just jump right into it. We do operate under an adopted wolf management plan that was the process or a product of a very long and difficult process, 2.5 years, and a tremendous amount of public involvement with that process. I mean, there are folks in this room that were very close to it. So one of the parts of the plan that I think is very helpful is that it does require evaluation every 5 years. So the original plan was adopted in 2010. We revised or reevaluated and updated the plan in 2005, the original plan. In 2010, we updated it. And, of course, the next update would be scheduled for 2015. A few of the principles that guide the formation of the plan go back 7 years ago in 2005 and still in many ways guide daily management of wolves in Oregon. That is that by state law, the department is required to conserve wolves under Oregon State Endangered Species Act. So our plan is based on conservation first and foremost, at least while populations, of course, are low. Our commission did clearly state that we would not actively reintroduce wolves. Of course, at that time, remember, most experts, some in this room, said we don't need to reintroduce or we never would. Wolves will be here. And, of course, those experts now, we know we're right. Probably the most difficult part of wolf management in general, and certainly a part that occupies daily management of wolves, and that's the third bullet that you see there, and that is the issue of livestock depredation. Providing producer assistance as best we can and trying to manage the issue of what happens when wolves eat somebody's property, eat livestock. Certainly, the fourth bullet, addressing impacts to deer and elk, is a important part of our plan. Of course, up to now, wolf populations have been fairly low, probably somewhat insignificant from that standpoint, but certainly as you will see in a minute how our population is increasing, that probably will become more and more of an interest to more Oregonians. The last one that I think is an important part of the wolf plan now and when it was developed is to provide flexibility in management of wolves while providing the needed protections. What that means is there was an assumption that wolves would come from Idaho, mostly from the reintroduced population in Idaho, and so far that has been the case. So as wolves enter, they enter eastern Oregon and establish. As that population increases, which it is, being able to provide some flexibility over time in that area while still maintaining protections in the rest of the state of Oregon was determined to be important, and I think it probably will still prove to be. So here's a good example of that. One of the things that the Oregon Wolf Plan does is it lays out a set of milestones or benchmarks, if you will, and it's a phased approach. Right now, we are in what would be considered the conservation phase, and that is phase one, from 0 to 4 breeding pairs. And what the definition of that is 4 breeding pairs for 3 consecutive years in eastern Oregon. At that point, when we reach that point, that would meet the population objective toward delisting of wolves. Remember, wolves are listed as endangered under Oregon ESA across the state. Phase two is a bit of a buffer phase, if you will, a sort of a recognition that we don't want to go backwards and we don't want to ever relist once delisted. I might also add in here, delisting is an important part or an important goal in the Oregon Wolf Plan. And we try to manage accordingly to that. Phase three is more of a management phase, and that's when some even greater flexibilities could occur as far as problem wolves, excessive depredation, or impacts to some of our deer and elk populations. That's sort of a real quick, very quick rundown of our plan. So how do we know when we're meeting these objectives, when we're reaching population objectives such as 4 breeding pairs or population numbers? Well, clearly it's through monitoring. Monitoring is a key part of wolf plan implementation, and it really is what tells us how we're meeting those goals. Right now, all of the wolves that we have collared, radio collared, and that is our primary method of understanding, especially established wolves, is through radio collaring. All of the collars that we have now, which are 10, use GPS technology, and both of the wolves that you see in these photographs have GPS collars on them. What these collars do is they allow us, they're a little different than the old, what you might remember as kind of the beep beep guy standing out with an antenna trying to get a direction. These actually use satellite technology similar to a handheld GPS, and they give us information right to our computer. One of the difficulties with these collars, they're very expensive. They give us tremendously more information on wolves than we got even 10 or 15 years ago, but they do have a high failure rate as well. Wolves are hard on collars. Wolves are hard on a lot of things, as you can imagine. Also, when we put these collars on these animals, which we have now installed 18 radio collars on wolves in Oregon, 10 of them we're monitoring now, some of these collars go out of state. They disperse. They go to other areas. And we've dispersed a number over the years. So where are we at with our population? That seems to be something that most want to know. Our population of wolves in Oregon is increasing and expanding. Expanding geographic area, increasing in numbers. We now have 6 known packs that we can account for in northeastern Oregon. All of those packs produced at least two pups that survive to the end of the year, which qualifies them as a breeding pair. So all 6 known packs in northeast Oregon are breeding pairs. Probably the most important part of this, of what you see here in these numbers, are 2012 was the first year that we met that original population objective that I mentioned earlier, and that is at least 4 breeding pairs that survive through the end of December. So with 6, we've met that first year. 2 more years, at least from a delisting standpoint, we could be in that position. 46 wolves were accounted for, 22 of those pups at the end of 2012. If we go back a couple of years, that's in contrast to 29 the year before, which would be 2011, and that would be in contrast to 21 the year before that. So you can sort of see how the population is increasing. And you also probably can tell a similarity as we have looked at wolves throughout the northern Rocky Mountain states. We started to see these populations climb at a pretty good rate, and we're seeing that, of course, now in Oregon. Just a visual representation of where Oregon's wolf packs occur. The two round circles that you see are packs. Well, the northernmost of the two is a pair of wolves that we are aware of in Wallowa County. The other round circle is a fairly newly discovered pack. We don't have any information on it, so that's why the round dot. The other irregular blue polygons, and I don't have a pointer here with me, the other irregular blue-shaped polygons in the northeast part of the state represent packs that we have radio collars and we actually have data for. So that's why you see the shape of those. This map also gives you an idea on where wolves are listed federally and delisted federally. That red line, the dark shaded area in the easternmost portion of the state, has been federally delisted in the spring of 2011. And the rest of the state remains federally listed. So wolves are listed under state ESA, of course, across the entire state. Talk a little bit about a not-so-pleasant subject, and that's livestock depredation. It does happen. In the year 2012, we continue to do a lot of investigations. These are cases where livestock producers think that they have depredation, and we go in and look to try to decide, did depredation occur by wolves? That number stayed about the same, and what is interesting is, though, the wolf population in 2012 increased, the number of actual incidences decreased, and there's been a lot of folks that I deal with have made comment of that. 8 confirmed incidences, which is down from 10 last year. Most of that is a result of the reduction in depredation by the Omnaha pack, probably a number of reasons for that. One of the interesting things, however, in northeast Oregon, even though the number of depredations decreased slightly during the year, the area increased. We had our first depredation in North Umatilla County, and that's the photos you see on this slide are in North Umatilla County. We also saw depredation occur in a very right on the edge of Baker County as well. Producer assistance is a keystone of our wolf plan. Our wolf plan is clearly based, at least while the populations are low and wolves are listed, to where non-lethal and preventative measures are key. Certainly takes up when we have depredation, that takes up a tremendous amount of our resources, time, personnel, and a lot of others as well, not just the agencies. Non-lethal measures, such as what you see in this photograph, which is electrified flattery to protect livestock, probably has varying effects effect. There's no question in the two depredations in North Umatilla County, for example, this year, we put Flattery around the same stuff that you see on this photograph around those sheep pens, and I'm quite convinced it helped a great deal. In other areas, it's very difficult to tell how much it helped. So it's kind of a mixed bag, but still important. We also issue what are referred to, and most everybody in this room knows them, and that is Cottony Act permits. And these are permits where a livestock producer could take a wolf if the wolf was caught biting, wounding, or killing their livestock. We do have right now, we have 21 of those permits issued, all in Wallowa County in association with the Mnaha Pack. One other thing I might bring up, too, that I think is important is because of this technology that we have in these collars now, the GPS technology and the fact that we get data the way we do on our computer, we can actually, in 2012, we developed a system by which many of these producers, if they sign up, they can actually receive a text message or an email message letting them know when wolves, at least the radio-collared wolves, are in the area of their livestock. Just in 2012, more than 10,000 of those messages were sent. We have right now 86 producers that receive those messages in three different counties. Most, of course, are in Wallowa County, again, associated with a depredating pack, the Mnaha Pack. Oregon's wolf plan does call for lethal control of wolves in certain situations, especially chronic damage. And in fact, so far in our history and in our modern history, we have removed four wolves in the state. Some of you will remember in 2009 the two Keating wolves that were removed following a long summer of trying to keep those two wolves out of sheep. Those two wolves were killed in the fall of 2009, and then following that, we removed two wolves from the Mnaha Pack in the spring of 2011. We are now under litigation starting October of 2011. And since that time, and that litigation challenges our authority to take wolves in Oregon. And since that time, we have not removed any wolves. So just to summarize, I guess, I think it's important to understand Oregon's wolves, no surprise, they are increasing, but they are following actually a similar pattern that we've seen in other states. So perhaps we have an opportunity here to learn some things from some of these other states. We are largely implementing our plan, minus, of course, parts of, because of litigation, parts of the lethal control part isn't fully implemented. And, of course, wolf management is a little bit more than challenging, not just from a personnel standpoint, but also from a financial standpoint. I mentioned these collars are very expensive. A lot of these non-lethal measures are very expensive. So wolf management is expensive in general. Challenges as our population increases to other species that the department manages, such as deer and elk. And then, of course, challenges and to the private sector as well, clearly. And with that, I would take some questions.
So we're going to hear from Carter first, and then I also want to mention we have Department of Agriculture here in the back. I know they're probably back there hiding, but I did ask if they could be here, so I'm going to ask them to come up in the front because at the end I'd like them to give a brief, very brief update on the Wolf Compensation Program, which is obviously a part of what you discussed, but it's administered by a different agency, the Department of Agriculture. So, Carter, welcome to Oregon, and thank you very much for making the trip here today.
Thank you, Chairman and fellow senators, to let me come over and speak briefly.
Can you just state your name again
for
the record?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Don't do this very often. My name is Carter Niemeyer, and I'm a former U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service person. Right now I'm a retired contractor, I guess would be my title. And I have spent 33 years with the federal government, 26 years with the U.S. Department of Agriculture Wildlife Services. Finished out my career in Boise, Idaho as the Wolf Recovery Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service there. While working for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, I was for 10 years, from about 1990 to 2000, a wolf depredation investigator. They call it a wolf management specialist, first of its kind at the time when wolves were reintroduced. So I've spent the lion's share of my career working in the field as a livestock investigator looking at predator damage. Again, I didn't come here with a lot to say other than I will say that wolves, I have learned, are very prolific animals. They're very resilient animals. If you don't shoot them, they can live just about anywhere and thrive. And probably the greatest success of wolves is their ability to disperse. People ask, why are they so successful? And it's because they can travel these tremendous distances. Oregon and Washington being the latest recipients of this behavior to disperse over large portions of the landscape. I just want to say it. I think Oregon has a great wolf plan. It's very important to have some kind of a roadmap to manage wolves as the numbers grow. I've worked a little bit with the state off and on, and I commend Russ. I didn't come here to give him attaboys, but he's done a great job, I think, in a very tough position. I was in that position once myself. There's no doubt that wolf numbers will continue to increase, and they will thrive, and they will be a challenging, polarizing issue, no doubt, wherever they've appeared on the landscape. And I'm not going to say a whole lot more other than I'd be happy to answer any questions when you get to that point.
Great. Thank you. And I wanted to see if Department of Ag is back there. So we're going to have just a very brief update, and then we'll open up for questions, because I'm sure there'll be questions. Thank you, Lauren. You can just hand him the microphone. That's okay. You can stay there. Lauren, if you can provide just a very quick background on our wolf compensation programs, the two in the state, and maybe talk about how they're being utilized and any updates that you have.
Yeah, good afternoon. For the record, Lauren Henderson. I'm the assistant director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And just as a reminder, last legislative session, the department was directed to establish the compensation program. It had $100,000 in it. And really, here to say today, I think the first year, given that it is a new program, went off pretty well. That is no luck. The counties worked very hard to get that program off the ground. We did have, for the 2012 grant period, which was August of 2011 to February, about $155,000 in requests. So there is no shortage of a need there. We did award out of that 82,000 of the 100 we had for the first year. That has presented some challenges because now we're in the second year. Don't have the new 100 that is currently in the governor's proposed budget for 13-15, so we had to be a little more judicious in this new cycle, and we're working through that, have not made awards yet. All of Wallowa County had the losses in 2012. They're the only county that did have those losses for that grant period. And the death and injury compensation in that county was fully paid for by the fund. It was, I believe, looking at my chart here, $13,000 was given to Wallowa County for those losses. No other county had any losses at that time. In addition, and I'm throwing out a lot of numbers here, and I will tell you that the department was also directed in the legislation to provide a report back to this legislature. We're working on that, and there will be a good report, I think, that comes to you. But out of the first round of 82,000 awarded, 80% of the dollars were allocated for prevention. I know there was much discussion about that when that went through. And so 66,000 went to preventative measures, just like you saw on the slide previously. 13,000 went for death and injury. And then only about 3,000 went to the actual county's implementation of the program, which was a fairly small number given the task that they had to do at that time. We are in the process right now of looking through the new requests for 2013, again, we had 88,000 in requests and only about 20 or 25,000 to allocate this time. We believe we're going to be able to cover the death and injury losses again. but we'll have a smaller number for the preventative measures going forward. We did have 8 counties apply the first time. We've now increased and added 2 counties, so we will have 10 that ask for dollars in this next cycle. And so I'll just stop there and answer any questions.
And Lauren, just a quick follow-up. Do you also implement the tax credit, or is that completely through the Department of Revenue?
No, that, Chair Dingfelder, that is through the Department of Revenue. Our role is to make sure, working with ODF&W and Revenue, that people aren't using both programs. They have to do one or the other.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, we'll open it up for questions, because I'm sure there's going to be some questions. Senator Hansel.
If I may, first of all, Mr. Niedermeyer, thank you very much for coming over here. And I've got a couple of questions, if I may. It seems to me that most likely in a PAC situation that the young ones learn from the adults, kind of a learned behavior, how to hunt and how to take food source. Would that be correct?
Mm-hmm.
And do you run into a situation where if there's a particular food source, say domestic, that you could end up with what might be called a problem pack, or that they choose to do that rather than, I mean, it would seem to me that that's a possibility. Does that ever happen?
Yes. Wolves generally recognize deer and elk as their principal prey, but there's a learned behavior sometimes where wolves cross the line. They get familiar with livestock. I think generally wolves are intimidated by livestock initially, but when they do cross the line and either eat dead beef or decide to tackle a vulnerable calf, they can develop this behavior. That's the time we always talk about, you know, preventative measures, non-lethal measures. You need to apply them early on before that stage happens. But generally, when you have a wolf pack that develops this behavior, it's very, very difficult to break them of that.
Follow up. Could you tell us a little bit? It's kind of my attention that Idaho had, maybe it was under your time, the White Hawk wolf pack. Was that one of those packs that developed that, and what happened there?
Yes, the White Hawk pack, we spent nearly 5 years using various preventative measures, non-lethal measures, radio collaring. I won't go into all the different tools, but we tried just about every tool in the box, from fladry to rag boxes. Eventually, that pack chalked up about 34 head of livestock, and it ended up that we lethally removed that entire pack.
And I'm assuming this was not in Oregon. This was in Idaho?
This was on the East Fork of the Salmon River in Idaho.
One more follow-up?
Yeah.
Russ, you said that in Oregon we have 6 packs. Do we have any, at this point, what maybe the department would say, a problem pack that this learned behavior that was over on the Idaho border is developing in Oregon at this point? Potentially, or of the 6 packs, do we have any that maybe be moving towards or have arrived at that same kind of learned behavior?
Senator Hansel, we do. The Amnaha pack, clearly starting in May of 2010, was the first depredation that we documented of that pack. And since then, I'm not sure I could tell you exactly how many depredations, confirmed depredations. I think it's about 26 losses and then a number of injuries. So I do know it's over 30. Despite the use of pretty significant non-lethal measures, not just by our agency, but also by the producers of the area. So whether it's the same, I'm not familiar enough with the case of the White Hawk pack, but clearly it is a long-standing depredation problem. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Hess, and then we'll go over and see if there's one here.
Thank you. I guess this is to the Department of Agriculture. The fund that you mentioned that is dwindling, we passed the tax credit, which was mentioned here earlier, and both of them go after the same policy, which is to make whole the ranchers who lost livestock. And the question has come up, why do we do both? Why would it, if the fund is a more efficient way to do this, couldn't we, I mean, I'm just asking your opinion on whether it would make more sense to say double the fund and eliminate the tax credit, or is there some balance there that I'm missing of having both?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Haas, I'm not an expert on the tax fund and maybe why that was. I can just speak for our fund. It's broader in the sense that it does cover those proactive measures as well as the losses. And so I think it really is up to the producers, I think, to look at the programs and choose the one that best meets their needs.
And that is slated, just a follow-up to that, is the depredation fund slated to, in the governor's budget, to be funded again at the same amount, $100,000?
Chair Dingfelder, yes, it is. It's right at $100,000 like it was before. I will also add, I think when our fund was set up, it was set up with the idea that there could be, would be donations. That hasn't happened yet. I think our hope is now that the fund is up and running and the county's block programs are up and running, maybe more confidence will be in the program and we may see some dollars move into that fund.
And maybe when we have the cattleman up here, we can ask him how that fund's working for them and any feedback they might have. So other questions? Did you have a question, Senator Bates?
I just real quick, if I could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mr. Niemeyer, since you're here and you're from Idaho, I've got a question for you. Now, this concerns elk and...
Make his trip worth the money.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to, but thanks for coming anyway.
Yeah.
And there are several families in southern Oregon that used to go to northern Idaho for elk hunts in the fall. And in the last couple of years, they stopped going because the local guides up there told them that the depredation of elk herds and the mule deer was so heavy it wasn't worth going. And the last couple of years they've stopped going because there just weren't any elk left. I know that's a very anecdotal story, but what's been the effect of on the elk and deer herds in Idaho with the increase of wolves?
Well, Senator Bates, my answer is probably going to be different than most people in Idaho. I can counter with anecdotal stories from out-of-state hunters who tell me they enjoy the fact that many of the Idaho hunters are telling everyone not to come and hunt, because I just met a hunter at an outdoor rally this weekend who said he's been coming over from Washington and very successfully killing very nice bull elk in an area over in the salmon region where the outfitters have been telling people don't come back because the elk hunting has been destroyed. But the northern panhandle, I don't know a lot about it other than I know it. You get into fire suppression. There's a lot of other issues that had been going on for a long time before the wolves came along.
Senator,
thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Olson, did you have a question?
Yes, I do. Mr. Niemeyer, first for you, thank you for coming over. It's a long trip, and we appreciate your expertise. Mr. Morgan, have the wolves gotten close to human living quarters and around livestock buildings that you know of?
Senator Olson, the short answer is yes, on a number of occasions. Certainly as these wolves, with the collars that we put on that I referenced, the GPS collars, we're able to tell the areas that they use. And there's many times wolves, just like other predators, are pretty close to human habitation. We've had some cases in Wallowa County where the pack or the wolves, individual wolves, would be sighted very near houses. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you have, are these cases documented so that you know which pack it is and which wolves they are?
Well, Senator Olson, we maintain data sets of wolf locations. So from that standpoint, yes. A lot of the reported sightings near houses are fairly anecdotal. We do have a wolf reporting system. I believe we received 280-something wolf reports just in the year 2012. Not all of those are, of course, right near humans, but with a state that's as developed as it is, there's certainly ample opportunity for wolves to be close to people.
Paula, we haven't had any lethal interaction between humans and wolves at this point yet, have we?
Senator Olson, no.
Follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
How many do I get?
Until I cut you off.
Okay, good.
No, I'm
You have some permits that you allow the livestock owners to have, lethal permits. Do they help the ranchers? Are they a good tool?
Senator Olson, I believe you're referring to the CAUT and the ACT permits. To date, the permits have not been, no wolves have been taking on a CAUT and the ACT permit. So from that standpoint, and well over 50 have been issued, there's 21 out now, 30-some last year, and no wolves were taken.
Follow up. What's the difficulty if a cattleman has his herd out there and these wolves are coming around? I assume they don't come in a small group. They come in their pack. And what's the difficulty of the rancher to actually be able to inhibit this approach with this permit?
Senator Olson, a good question. The first difficulty is that we should always remember that wolves are secretive large carnivores. They're primarily nocturnal. So most of these depredations or most of these encounters around livestock are going to occur at night. And in fact, we believe that's exactly what happens. And of course, they're just secretive. So like many other predators, we just don't see them all the time. So the fact that it would be rare to see a wolf, and many of the producers, and I'll give an example, in Wallowa County, as much as has happened over the last 2 years, there's many livestock producers that have not even seen the wolves. Some of those folks are in this room. So, yeah.
And it's for Mr. Henderson. On the awards and things like that, does this make the farmer whole, or is it is he given any additional money for the other mental state of his other cattle, or is it just for the cow he loses?
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Olson, the counties are charged with setting up their criteria for the value that they determine on those animals, and we have left it up to them to do that. They have to have an advisory committee. It has a certain membership requirement, and so We're getting from the counties now their allocations and their methodology for doing that, and it has a pretty rigorous process for doing that, and so I couldn't speak to any one county and how their methodology is, but we'll have that in the report when we get that.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, thank you very much, gentlemen. We are going to move on to our next panel, but we'd ask you to be prepared. If there's a time at the end, we may ask you to come back up if there's some last questions. So really appreciate all of you coming here today. I know both you, Carter, and Russ came from far away, so appreciate hearing your testimony. So next we're going to hear from the cattleman and ranching perspective, Curtis Martin, who's president of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, Dr. Douglas Johnson, who's with the Department of Rangeland Ecology and Management at Oregon State University, and Rod is from Wallowa County. Mr. Martin, would you like to go first?
Sure.
Yep.
Yes, I just want to say thank you, Chair Dingfelder, for this opportunity to come forward and kind of give you an update of where the cattle industry is at right now and the efforts that we've been involved in. So I want to defer the most of my time to our Wolf Committee Chairperson, Rod Childers. I am Curtis Martin, the Oregon Cattlemen's Association President, and I reside, our home ranch is in Baker Valley, North Powder. So Rod and I had the privilege of coming down earlier this morning to be here, so we appreciate that. At that point in time, I'd like to defer to our Chair of the Wolf Committee, Rod Childers. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Rod. You just need a microphone. Just one's fine.
I don't need them both.
Yeah. thank you, Senator. I appreciate you holding this informational hearing and things. And I'm going to kind of do the same thing. I've got a short update here, but I want to defer quite a bit here to Doug Johnson. We've been involved in a wolf research, livestock interaction research study for 5 years now, and so we think he's got quite a bit of things that are important to say.
And can you state your name for the record for folks listening on the over the Internet?
Yes. Thanks. It's Rod Childers, and I'm from Wallowa County, and I am the Oregon Cattlemen's Wolf Committee Chairman.
Thank you. Thanks.
So, and I think the thing that I kind of wanted to touch here, Russ has talked about the depredations and quite a few of our issues, and we're working closely with the agency and things. to try to monitor and to prevent this from happening. But throughout the time since 2010, when we were notified that the wolves were in Wallowa County and things, we've done non-lethal activities. I think we started putting rag boxes out on some of the ranches close to Joseph, Oregon, there within about 5-6 miles in the end of January. And since then, and things, the producers in that area, and there's well over 50 of them that received these text messages as they got the wolves collared there. We've got one producer for that started. He was notified the wolves were there in March. He had depredations in May. Things on that, he was doing non-lethal. He's got a four-wheeler. His land's accessible there, kind of on the open prairie. He started going out at night. He, the ODFW gave him a call, a receiver to use for the VHF callers and the GPS to try to locate, to move him off when he was notified they were in the area. He lost a, he had a depredation that spring. Come 2011, he and just kept right on with the non-lethal. Whether he put up the phylactery also, he had two cows killed in February of 11 there, and then that spring later in May he had another one in a calf, and here just last month he lost another cow. And the non-lethal, and he's applied the rag boxes, the electric fencing, the range rider, anything that the agency has suggested. And I might add that Defenders was involved in non-lethal and also paying for compensation on livestock in 2010 up until September of 11. And anything that was suggested that we've tried. We haven't turned our nose up at any of the non-lethal techniques. But the thing is that, as Mr. Morgan said, is that we keep having depredations. And now we're under the suit, the Cottony Act permits. They have been, the people, that some of the guys that have seen them. I have not seen the wolves there. I've been out there a lot, but just haven't run onto them and things. They are very nocturnal. And so I think, you know, we need more than just non-lethal. And try to, the compensation plan doesn't make you whole. The plan was to compensate for a livestock. It doesn't go for the extras and the mental and the conception rates on your herds, loss of weight and things like that. But I'd like to defer to Doug and let him go ahead and explain quite a bit of that.
Thank you.
Okay, Chair Dingfelter and committee. My name is Douglas Johnson, and I'm with Oregon State University. And we've been conducting some research in both Idaho and in Oregon for about the last 5 years. So I'll just go through some of this. I think it'll explain some of what we face. So one of the things that we've done is we've put GPS collars on livestock. And this is 10 collars. It's the positions. So the little red dots are positions of those 10 collars every 5 minutes from the time they go out. They're turned out until the time they come back and they're gathered. And this just shows the movement of that herd across that area. This is the same area, and it's a close-up of an area that has had some depredation. And there were 15 confirmed or probable depredations here. What I've done is on the map, I've put in black the major roadways. The roadway running through the center of this image is actually paved. And then the places where you see a cow image, that's a depredation site. There was a question earlier about the position of houses. These are occupied houses. These are houses which have people in them year-round. So some of the depredation occurs quite close to houses. You can see the scale at the bottom. In 2009, in this area, we collared a wolf. And this wolf was logged at 15-minute intervals. And his average travel distance on a daily basis was about 11.4 miles. This is over about 200 days. The occupied area for him was about 210 square miles. And what was interesting was that 3.1% of all his wolf positions was within 500 meters of a house. And that's only counting the houses that are in our study area. There may be other houses in this area, because it's quite extensive, that I don't know about that are occupied. One of the things we were interested in seeing is how far he could travel in 1 hour or 2 hours. And so in 1 hour of continuous movement, his maximum was 6.29 miles. In 2 hours of continuous movement, he went 8.39. So they have a prodigious ability to move. Because we have the GPS locations on cows at 5-minute intervals and on the wolf at 15-minute intervals, we could see the juxtaposition of these animals throughout the entire grazing season. And so there were 10 collared cows. At the end of the year, when they came back and we downloaded the data, because these are store-on-board collars, they don't broadcast positions, these animals all had had interactions with that wolf at 500 meters, and the count is there. So there were actually a total of 783 encounters between cows and that wolf at 500 meters. If we went through and just looked at positions that were within 250 meters, there were 244. If we drop that down to 100 meters, there were 53 of those positions. And the animals that are marked with a star there and highlighted in blue actually came home without calves. So 2 out of the 10 animals lost their calves. They were not found, and so they were just registered as missing. One of the things that we were interested in doing is just looking at the interaction between these animals. And so I'm going to show you a little movie. And what this movie is of that same area. It's 29.45 miles across. The wolf is going to be down here in red. And the cows are actually orange dots that'll fade to white. So you'll be able to see the direction that the wolf moves and how the cows move in this, if I can find, there you go, in this little movie. So the wolf actually is on the den site down there. Now he's moving off of it. He came back to the den site. This is on July 2nd. You can see the date and the time, although I have to warn you the time is in universal time, so it's Greenwich Mean Time. You can see he's moved over. Actually, where he is now is in the calving pasture for the heifers. And so this particular ranch divides its heifers and has them calve in a separate area. Now he's up in the hills, and that's actually a fairly remote area. He's going to move back across. There's another favorite spot up there that he hangs out at quite a bit.
What's the I can't, it's hard to tell what the lapse time is. This over?
This is actually, now we're on the 5th of July,
yeah,
and he's back at the den site. But if you noticed, he just went through that group of cows. Mm-hmm. So this is the first interaction. This is the first time when we've recorded him there. Now, see, the next day he goes back up to, or the next night, actually, he goes back up to those cows. He was in the cows. Now he's cut back around. The thing to notice here is how far that wolf can travel. I mean, it's an amazing distance. Now he's back up to a favorite spot. He comes back across. He goes back down to the den site. And then this is on the 7th. And the next day, he's right back with the cows. So what we've done, actually, is we've made these little movies for these about 10-day intervals throughout the year. But I guess the take-home message here is how far that animal can travel, how extensive that wolf movement is in relationship to those cows. And you can see now the cows have kind of spread out away from that wolf. Where he actually ends up here is a rendezvous site that the wolf pack used. This was one wolf out of a pack of 13. And this pack was removed by the end of August, except for this wolf, because it was carrying a collar, and another wolf that had a broadcast collar on it. So we were interested in seeing whether or not the wolf predation altered the position or the grazing area of the livestock. And so if you look up on the upper left-hand side, that's July 2008, and this is just the distribution of cow positions in July. The main ranch headquarters here and its pastures are identified with those black lines. So those are pastures on the home ranch. In 2009, which is heavy wolf presence here, 2008, I think they lost, well, actually I have the exact numbers, but they lost less than five animals to depredation. 2009, they lost 15 that were probable or confirmed, and they ended up having right around 65 head that were unaccounted for at the end of the grazing year or the grazing season. So on that position in July, you can see the locations in red dots of that wolf, and then the yellow dots represent where the cattle were. So it appears that the presence of this wolf and this wolf pack have pushed these animals down towards the ranch. So in other words, I don't know whether those animals are going there because they assume that it's safer near the ranch or whether they're just being pushed out of the area and they run up against fences, but that's where they end up. Then 2010, as I mentioned, 2009, that pack was removed. 2010, there was another relatively light year. I think they lost somewhere between three and five or seven depredations that were confirmed. 2011 was again high. It was, I think, 15 or thereabouts. So we went from moderate wolf presence to heavy wolf presence, and in those heavy times, it appears that those animals, that the livestock are being pushed closer to the home ranch. And just to reiterate what Russ said, when you look at the activity, this is wolf B446, and this is the distance traveled per hour. And you can see he can travel any time of the day. This is averaged over the whole summer and fall. He can move at any time of the day, but most of his movement is taking place at night. I might also add that this is a pretty gutsy wolf because, as I said, they were removing this pack. They shot four wolves out of this pack, and within 24 hours, he was within 500 meters of a house. So he didn't seem to be too worried about human presence. So basically, wolves can frequently interact with livestock, and they do that mostly at night. All but one of our approaches at less than 100 meters took place at night. Wolves alter livestock behavior. We've noticed some of the spatial change in the behavior, just say they change their areas where they spend time. And we've also noticed that they change the temperament of the animals. The animals have a tendency to be much more aggressive. The cattle have a tendency to be much more aggressive when they've been under heavy wolf pressure. We also have a component of the study which is looking at the economic analysis of wolves. That's being done by Dr. Neil Rimby over at the University of Idaho. But there's no doubt that it increases the workload on the ranch, increases the workload on the rancher, and there are costs associated with it. Often the cattle that are hit by wolves are still alive, and so there can be substantial investment by the rancher in the veterinary costs trying to keep these animals going. So, as you go from agricultural production system to agricultural production system, the way that you can protect these animals changes. And on these extensive landscapes, it's very, very difficult to do much. When we typically will see cattle disperse over large areas, so animals in the same herd may be 5 miles apart. And so to provide some sort of a protection to a dispersed herd of 350 cows over, 8 square miles is very difficult. So at any rate, there's no easy fixes on this. I think that we have to have solid data in order to make rational decisions, and so that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to get as much information together as possible. And I just might add that this is a collaborative project, so it's being done by Dr. Pat Clark, who's at ARS, myself, and John Williams, who are both with OSU, Neil Rimby. And we've also had a fair bit of help from the engineering groups because we make our own collars, and which keeps the cost a little bit lower. We've also, Pat told me that he's got a patent pending for a device that works on key fob technologies, so that if, you know, the cow is carrying a transmitter and the wolf has got a receiver, and if they come into into proximity, sets off an alarm with the on the wolf. The issue with that is trying to get the collar on the wolf. You know, it's like belling the cat. So, at any rate, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Thank you very much. I'll see if there's any questions. I've got a few, and I also wanted to just note for the committee members that we do have copies of your paper.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to reading the more details on the research that was done, and thank you for sharing that. Questions, Senator Hess?
Thank you. Your presentation, especially the movie showing the movement, was really remarkable. And you said something that made me think about the damage to livestock herds where maybe there's no injury, no lethal, no fatality or anything, that there is an effect and maybe even a cost, I hate to say,
yes,
psychologically, but how does that manifest? So what does that look like, and how are costs incurred for that?
Okay.
Kind of thing?
Because we track these animals at 5-minute intervals, we can look at the interaction or the travel distance of a cow before and after an encounter. In some animals, what you'll see is there'll be an encounter, and then the activity of that animal is very, very high. Lots of movement through the day, and so they go from having this sort of a lazy kind of a demeanor to all of a sudden very, very active. In other cases, you'll see proximity and no change in the behavior in terms of the spatial behavior. So I think that there's probably quite a few of the animals that end up getting worked up over that, but it may be that the cow doesn't actually know that the wolf was there. It may have, passed by. I ask the ranch hands on this particular ranch how often they see wolves, and they tell me once, maybe twice a year. It's not a common occurrence. It's very rare. You hear them, and you see signs, but you typically don't see the wolf itself.
Senator Olson?
Dr. Johnson, thank you. That was a very informative report. You might want to consider using prepaid cell phones. They have great GPS technology, and they're cheap.
Actually, we do have a number of different types, and one of them does have a satellite phone in it, so it can call back, but it increases the weight a little bit. So with wolves, it's a little tougher.
Just a little sidebar.
Yeah.
Mr. Childers.
Yes, sir.
The department tells you that, the wolves are out there. Does this help? Is this good reporting system? Does it help you to detour the cows from the wolves or the wolves from the cows?
Well, the thing with it is that we get the ODFW gets the download, and then we receive it once every 24 hours. Now, so we get the last download that I think they're set on every 3 hours. They can be set at different time frames, so 3 or 6 hour intervals or whatever. Well, we'll get, right now I'm getting 4 downloads a day, so it's once every 6. The most updating one is, say, they comes at 6 o'clock in the morning. I get the text message around 6:30 or so. Thing. So I know where the wolf was, not where he's at. So they, trying to use non-lethals and to show, and people say, well, you got to be out there. Well, so you don't know. Yeah, he can be 11 miles away from you, and I can go out there in an hour and hear he's standing and things, but I'm not aware of that. The text messages, we do utilize them. I mean, the guys will say, okay, they're here. So we'll go out, and whether we we scare the wolf off or not, the topography of our country and things, you know, you're running from 2,500 feet up to 5,000, a lot of canyons, a lot of timber. We don't see them, the VHF receivers that we utilize and that we're given. If it's not line of sight, you don't see it. No, whether it's a benefit or not. We think it is, but we can't say for sure.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
I made a note here that you have a large cost for injured cattle. Mm-hmm. Is it beneficial to, if a cow's been mauled a little bit, is it beneficial to save that so it can calf again? Because you certainly can't sell it for beef then, can you?
No, it depends upon how extensive the injuries and things. There was a calf that was injured up this summer up there, and the ranchers took it on. The veterinarians actually looked at it and some of the bios and said, you probably ought to put it down. And the guy took it home, and he couldn't bring himself to do it. And he brought it back to health and things. Mm-hmm. So, but very tough, very time-consuming. And, you know, and it's just... You watch these things be born. You don't want to watch them die and things like that. And
well, so you do sell it so I can have roast beef, don't you?
You bet. Yeah.
So you don't watch that part of it.
Are you trying to get like a discount on your roast beef or something?
Just one other follow-up question. I'm kind of interested because we're talking about wolves, but do you have any predation from mountain lions?
Mountain lions? To my knowledge, I've been in Wallowa County for over 35 years, and I have yet to lose a cow or a calf from a mountain lion.
I was just wondering if, because they're out there too, I just wondered what they were doing.
One thing that I would throw into that is that in about 1986, I've got an allotment that I run in common with three other permittees, and we had a bear come in that spring, and we found the 8 calves that through, there was about 1,000 head of cows that was running in common there together. And we found 8 calves that bear had depredated on. But we were able to take hounds out and immediately go and take care of that and stop that problem and things. So that time I do know of that being with a bear. But with a cat, I can't say, I don't know of any.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You bet.
Ansel?
Two quick questions. Dr. Johnson, where were that map that you showed, the interaction, where was what? Where is that located?
It's just across the border from Oregon. So the Snake River, I don't know if you remember it, the Snake River is on the left, and they have what they call the Oxbow. So this is actually a ranch that runs all the way from the Snake River, which is just adjacent to Oregon, up to, it's below the Seven Devils area.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So I was thinking it might be in Oregon, but when you said they were taking wolves, then I figured it must be over.
Yeah, no, it was. It's just across. Actually, that wolf came within about 700 meters of Oregon at one time.
Yeah. And then my second question, follow-up, Mr. Childers, I would just, as a producer, you know, we have the permit, which, you know, been 50, 70, something like that, not one take because the wolves are. What's your thought of a permit-less take? It doesn't seem to be that scary of a thing. Would that help if the depredation, if you came on it or saw it or could do something with it? I'd be interested in your reaction to that.
Well, Senator, I think the take bill that's in now, that to my knowledge, the thing is that it's no different. The language is no different than in our Cottony Act permits. So to me, it's not going to be a benefit and things that as it's written and things because of the language. You still got to catch them in the act to be able to use a permitless take. And you know, maybe save somebody from handing you a piece of paper, but it's not. There's no difference in the restrictions, the use of it.
So I have a quick. Do you have any more?
Nope.
Yeah. I have a quick question for Dr. Johnson. I was going to ask the same question that Senator Hansel did about where that was, and when you said Seven Devils, I knew. But as far as in relation to elk herds, I'm curious about, you know, we had Senator Bates asked the question, And is there, have you done any studies looking at depredation in relation to elk herds, and where, you know, is it that they're not in the same area that elk herds are, or is it just that it's a lot more work to be, you know, following elk herds than it is cattle? Can you talk a little bit about the interaction?
Yeah, I haven't studied that, and so everything that I tell you is probably just speculation, but there are people in Idaho that are studying the effect of wolves on elk herds. There was a fellow by the name of Craig White. I think he's probably still doing that. There are elk in this area, and so there are elk in the area. There's quite a few deer in the area. So,
yeah, I guess my question, and maybe I'll ask Carter to come back up at the end to answer this, is the fact that the wolves in the, you know, a certain area, they're preying on the cattle because there's not enough elk, or is it because they're not in close proximity? Or I'm sure it looks like Rod's dying to give me his thoughts on that, and then I'll probably have Carter come up and, yeah.
I can't hide my emotions on that one. The Chess Nimitz area in Wallowa County, the Amnaha Pack, utilizes the Zumwalt country, which is about 80, 90,000 private property acres. There's 3,500 head of elk on that area where some of these Amnaha depredations have been. At the same time, the elk are there, the cattle's just getting turned out. So we've got lots more elk than what we really want on private property. And the commission, I will recognize, has bumped the elk tags up there to try to help with that. But 3,500 down there.
We haven't figured out how to get elk tags to the wolves yet, though, right?
There you go. Yeah.
And one last question about, and again, this may be for ODF&W, but I'd like to hear your perspective on it, the percentage of depredations that are occurring on private land versus public lands. Because I noticed, I'm assuming those black lines were the private ranch lands, and it looks like, you know, obviously we're not fencing off. We have open range land, and I'm assuming it's much harder to do fladry and non-lethal when you're in open range. So I'd certainly like to hear your perspective on that.
Oh, Senator Dingfelder, on that there is that the Amnaha Pack and things, maybe a couple of probables and maybe a couple of confirmed injuries plus one confirmed death as far as on public land. So say around 30, 25 of those have been, 25 have been all on private property and things in kind of those black lines. And that's the thing when you start looking at fladry or rag boxes and things. And the rag boxes, they're the noisemakers when the wolf comes so close with a collar that they'll go off and there's noise and then there's different lights and things. So to try to scare them back away, we employ those around cabin areas and things. But what we've been told is 40 to maybe an 80 acre pasture for fladry and up to maybe a quarter, half a mile on a rag box. And otherwise you're starting to get out there quite a bit, and economically fladry you just can't do it and maintain it, things in our setting. So
would you like to add to that?
Yes, thank you, Chair Dingfelder. I guess Senator Haas isn't here right now, but I kind of wanted to elaborate on his questioning about the further economic hardships it's put on with cattle, and just to go on with what Dr. Johnson said, that in reality the depredations are probably the minimal of the economic damage that's occurred to ranches. The other economic factors there that play in so dramatically are weight loss. Conception rates are very dramatically dropped. The temperament of the cattle are changed so that they do not range. Their body score, the brood cow's body score will come in at a much lower rate than what has been previous to wolf activity. So if you, and that's part of the economic factors that we have enlisted with our Beef Council dollars and Oregon Cattle, and that's part of the study that we really want to get a full picture to everyone so that you can understand the whole big picture impact of wolf and cattle interactions and conflicts. So I just wanted to elaborate that on a little bit.
Great. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I really appreciate your coming here today. Did you have sorry.
Just a couple quick questions.
Senator Bates was out and...
Yeah, I had to take a call from practice. I saw numbers here that not depredation, but loss of weight, things you were just talking about, were about $250 a head. I just read very quickly on that, and I think, Dr. Johnson, you brought those figures up. When I was raising cattle, we were lucky to get $600-$700 a head, and to me that would be, I mean, we wouldn't even be raising cattle at that rate. I mean, it wasn't really worth the money we put into them, the time we put into them, the grain we put into them, and put them on the field. So that was one question, is how much you're getting ahead. I mean, how much is this affecting your actual outcomes financially? And the second question was kind of a strange one, probably a stupid one. Anyone using dogs to try to keep the wolves off the cattle? And is anyone doing it? Is it working, or just a waste of time? Give them one more thing to eat. I mean, what's happening?
Well, I can speak to the dog issue, and that is that there have been guard dogs killed by wolves in our study areas. So it's when you have a pack of wolves, it's very difficult to have enough dogs to be able to protect the livestock.
And do you want to answer the financial piece of that?
On the financial end, that's the direct loss that John Williams that wrote for the financial side, the papers that you got there, yeah. And things are, right now, a weaned calf in the fall is somewhere worth around, last fall they were worth right around $800 to $850 and things. So, and your profit out of that, your gross right now, or your cost, and things, your expenses on that is somewhere over $600, six up to $700 a head. We're feeding $220 hay right now, so it gets expensive. And but when you take that loss out of that on that gain, there's no net income left and things with that.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate you coming all the way over here today, and thank you for your paper. Look forward to reading that.
Okay,
really appreciate
you.
Your input. And last, we're going to hear from the non-lethal panel, I guess we could say. We have Suzanne Stone from Defenders of Wildlife, Robert Clavins from Oregon Wild, and I was going to say Amarok Weiss, am I getting that right, from Center for Biological Diversity. And thank you for coming here as well. Whoever wants to get started.
I guess that will be me. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I appreciate your having this hearing today. My name is Amarok Weiss. I'm the West Coast Wolf Organizer for the Center for Biological Diversity, which is a conservation organization that advocates for endangered species. We have over 500,000 members and supporters nationwide, and just about 12,000 of them live here in Oregon. We do support the recovery of wolves in Oregon, but we also support strong science-based management to help livestock operators reduce any possibility of livestock loss. And since I haven't recently testified here, I am going to take just a moment to elaborate on my background to tell you what brings me here today. Since 1997, I have worked on wolf conservation issues in Alaska, the Northern Rockies, the southwestern United States, and the Pacific West. My focus is on wolf conservation policy and its implementation. So I'm here today as a representative of the Center for Biological Diversity, but also because out of all the people testifying today, I'm the only person here that was appointed back in 2003 by the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to be a stakeholder representative on the Wolf Advisory Committee that developed the State Wolf Plan. And you had asked some questions about the Wolf Plan earlier. I would like to touch on that just a little bit briefly because I think there's a good comparison of then and now when we look at the big picture. So like all of the 14 appointed stakeholder advisors in that process, I invested a substantial amount of time, including hundreds of hours of meetings, reading, research, listening, negotiating. We all worked really, really hard on that plan. The plan that was ultimately crafted represented a social and political compromise. It set extremely low minimum recovery goals for the wolf population, and conservationists compromised on a lot of things that touch really quite to the core of their values. A strictly scientifically based wolf plan would have been more protective of wolves. We do know that the Cattlemen's Association, which is also part of the advisory committee, never signed on to the plan, and they've been rather opposed to the plan and legislative components in the time since the plan was adopted. So we've also heard that the background of wolves here in Oregon This all arrived back in 1999 when the first Idaho wolf came across the border, and at that time, state officials here didn't even realize that the gray wolf was listed under Oregon's Endangered Species Act, and they asked the federal government to come and take that wolf back. But by 2003, all of that had changed. Three more wolves had crossed into Oregon, and all of them ended up dead. One was killed by a vehicle, the other two were illegally shot. And so by this time, the commission was well aware that it had an obligation to protect a returning native endangered species, and public support for wolves at that time coming back to Oregon was overwhelming. A professional poll conducted by the firm of Davis and Hibbets back in 1999 found that 70% of Oregonians favored wolves coming back to the state. And the fact is, that figure hasn't wavered in all of this time. In 2010, you heard that the commission undertook a five-year review of the state wolf plan. And at that time, they received 20,000 comments on the plan. Over 90% of those comments said that they wanted more protections for wolves. This will of the people to preserve and protect the wolf, that can be accomplished. But at the same time, with science-based techniques, the cattlemen's interests can also be protected. We want livestock producers to get help in doing so. We realize there may always be some loss, but it's also important to keep the numbers in perspective. And you've seen some numbers here today and some interesting studies that are all worth considering. I'd like to throw out just a few more numbers here. The livestock industry in Oregon includes over 1.3 million cattle. Now, right now we have 47 wolves. Of those 1.3 million cattle, in the last year for which we have statistics, which is 2010, are the most recent figures that have been put forth by NAS, the National Agricultural Statistics Service, over 55,000 of those cattle were lost to weather, disease, and human thieves. Four were lost to wolves that year. So the answer to keeping these numbers low is not to kill an endangered species, but to implement the conflict prevention methods. And the state already has programs for preventing conflict, plus a compensation program, plus this tax credit program. Back to the plan. When wolves remained endangered, the state wolf plan contemplated killing wolves as a conflict management tool, but only as an option of last resort. And instead, we've seen the department over the years come under political pressure to move a lot more quickly to kill wolves in direct violation of the spirit of the wolf plan and the letter of the law. This resulted in our filing a legal challenge 2 years ago, which you've also heard mentioned today. So in that time, due to the judge's order, no wolves had been killed by agency staff as a means to resolve conflict, and the sky hasn't fallen. Quite the contrary. During this time, the department, conservation organizations, and livestock producers have worked together to use non-lethal conflict prevention techniques. The wolf population has increased, as you've also heard, while at the same time, evidence shows that the wolf-livestock conflicts have dramatically decreased. So I'm going to share my time here with my other panelists. I'm going to thank you for the opportunity to present our perspective on wolf management today in Oregon. And my fellow panelists are going to elaborate on these conservation, proactive approaches to coexisting with wolves that we and the vast majority of Oregonians all desire.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Suzanne, do you have a presentation? Yes.
Do you want to jump in?
Yeah.
Or mine's short. And
okay, why don't you go while we're loading up the presentation?
Mine's short, and I'll keep myself constrained to my written comments. Some of it's a little redundant with what Amaruk said, but Suzanne has some really good stuff, so I'll make sure I don't linger too long. Senator Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Clavins. I'm the wildlife advocate for Oregon Wild. We're a conservation organization that represents over 10,000 members and supporters across the state, and they support our mission to protect the wildlands, wildlife, and water that make our state such a special place. As part of that mission, we work to keep common species like elk and meadowlarks common, and it also means working to restore wildlife like wolves and salmon that may need a little extra help retaking their place on the landscape. We also want to see wolf recovery that works for everyone. We want to see meaningful, healthy, and sustainable populations of wolves and all other native wildlife. That includes seeing farmers, hunters, birdwatchers, and outfitters alike flourishing alongside wildlife. Despite some serious misgivings, we supported the Compromise Wolf Plan of 2005 that we've heard about today, and we spent the next several years supporting ODFW's implementation of the plan, advocating for full funding, and defending against attacks against the plan and efforts to make it easier to kill endangered wildlife. It's worth noting, I think it's remarkable, that in 2009, when the plan was put to its first test, the state fulfilled both the spirit and the letter of the Wolf Plan. We didn't celebrate the decision to ultimately kill two of the state's then dozen or so wolves, but we also did not oppose that lethal control. In ensuing years, we saw annual attacks on the plan and broader wildlife protections in the state legislature, at the ODFW Commission, and on the ground with continued wolf poaching. In 2011, ODFW was subject to increasingly intense pressure to kill wolves to address conflict, and along with other conservation groups, we challenged the state's decision in court. We're continuing now to work with the state and stakeholders to get back to the wolf plan that we thought we had in 2005, and though we can't share details, we believe we're close to a resolution that will hopefully be in front of the legislature this session. In 2012, the state was barred from killing wolves, and we were pleased to see non-lethal efforts to prevent conflict taken more seriously, comprehensively, and faithfully implemented. As you've heard, not surprisingly, wolf recovery got back on track, but along with that increase in wolf numbers, conflict also decreased dramatically, and that's what everyone says that they want. Meanwhile, in our neighboring states, we saw that wolf killing only fed controversy. Much of last year's success was made possible by the foresight of this legislature that approved a compensation program and facilitated the implementation of non-lethal conflict prevention that we've heard about today. The legislature also wisely opposed efforts to weaken safeguards and make it easier to kill endangered wildlife in Oregon. The wolf issue tends to be full of misinformation and fear, and some say that wolves are decimating the livestock industry, wiping out game herds, and killing kids at the bus stop. But sadly, the controversy around wolves and wildlife has a lot less to do with the realities and more to do with the broader conflicts that tend to divide our country and our state. Over the years in this building, we've heard from some that the only solution to conflicts with endangered wildlife is to kill them, and we strongly disagree. We're confident that the overwhelming majority of Oregonians share that view. In neighboring states, we've seen that killing endangered wildlife only feeds controversy. Oregonians overwhelmingly value native wildlife, and rational actors in the livestock industry, conservation community, hunting community, and government agencies are focusing on common ground, science-based solutions. And with so many serious problems facing Oregon, that makes sense. Rarely in this building do we get a chance to talk about the positive impacts of wildlife. They provide tangible economic, ecological, social, and recreational benefits, as well as those that are harder to quantify. In fact, healthy, abundant wild populations of native wildlife living in places, both tame and wild alike, are a part of what make Oregon such a special place. And Oregon scientists, unfortunately, who weren't able to make it today but have testified in the other chamber in recent years, are leading the world in demonstrating the irreplaceable role wolves play on the landscape. It's evidence of a healthy state. No one wants wildlife to impose hardships on anyone, but living with native wildlife is a responsibility shared by all Oregonians, not an onerous burden. In recent years, we've focused on education, conservation, and preventing conflict, including supporting efforts to ensure funding for those efforts. In Oregon, we tend to do things better than other places, and especially when it comes to our shared natural heritage, we tend to do them right, and we should strive to keep it that way. Thanks for giving me the time today.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Suzanne Stone, and I'm the Western Representative for Defenders of Wildlife on Wolf Conservation. I live in Idaho and have been working on the ground there since before we had wolves, so I'm getting to see kind of a deja vu effect here in Oregon of where we were many years ago and are still struggling with some of the things to resolve some of the conflicts with wolves in our state. I wanted to bring you a little bit of slice of hope, though. I don't know what's going on there, but we have a project in central Idaho in Blaine County that is in its sixth year this year. We're in one of the areas where the heaviest concentration of livestock and wolves in the state. We've had in the past chronic depredations in those areas and the removal of wolves and the loss of a lot of livestock there. However, since we started using our non-lethal tools in that area, we've been able to reduce our losses down to near zero for both livestock and wolves. And so rather than bring all my project partners, which I would love to have done, I'm going to show you this very short clip, if it'll work for us, and you can hear it from their words.
Trees' tolerance for living with wolves is now facing its greatest test. It is a land of great potential for the large carnivores, big on space and rich with prey. but it is also a land where livestock still rules the open range. It is a land of raw human emotions, infused with fear and distrust, ingrained from generations past.
If I see a wolf, if he's close enough to where he's supposed to be worrying my sheep, I'm going to shoot him.
John Faulkner is a third-generation sheepman who runs one of the largest sheep operations in Idaho, much of it on public land. And ordinarily, he would have no hesitation if he saw a wolf near his sheep. But in the Wood River Valley of Idaho's Sawtooth National Forest, John Faulkner and other sheep ranchers are attempting a different approach toward keeping sheep and wolves apart without deadly bullets. With the help from the conservation group Defenders of Wildlife, Idaho Fish and Game, U.S. Forest Service, and U.S. Wildlife Services, the ranchers of the Wood River Valley have been testing their non-lethal techniques in what is considered the sheep superhighway of central Idaho, patrolled as it is by the resident Phantom Hill Wolf Pack.
On the hour, every hour, get up and turn my telemetry on, see if there are any signals from the local wolves that have collars. And I'm switching between the alpha male and the alpha female, which are the two wolves in the pack that have collars. I can only pick up signals from wolves that are wearing the radio collars.
Jesse Timberlake is the manager of the Wood River Project for the Defenders of Wildlife. As well as he must watch his sheep, Timberlake must watch his wolves.
Last night, there were wolves howling all around, just on the ridge above where the sheep were. So when they do that, then I get up and start walking around the sheep, making sure they're right. If the wolves keep on howling, then I have an air horn I might use to scare them away, or a little starting pistol.
For more than a decade now, since wolves returned to the Rocky Mountains, the Defenders of Wildlife have been paying ranchers to compensate for their losses. Here in the Wood River Valley, where the losses were once more frequent, they've lately found that new precautions have largely precluded those payments.
It's going to cost them more money to pay off us than what they're going to spend on their two people they had out with that one band over there. This year we didn't have any trouble over there but one. And they weren't there that night.
Are they done?
And the herder saw four or five wolves the next morning.
Another collaborator in this groundbreaking experiment in non-lethal wolf control is Mike Stevens of Lava Lake Lam, whose introduction to raising sheep in wolf country was a lesson never to be forgotten.
In 2002, we had wolves come into that sheep band in three successive nights, and they killed a total of 18 ewes and lambs. So that was a pretty big wake-up call for us. Then we started implementing a number of proactive measures at that time.
And that turns on the alarm, which has this high-intensity strobe light and two speakers that have noise that changes. In a situation like this, it's just to alert the herder, because the sheep are already in, they're not going to be in this enclosure, but we want to let the herders know, you better get up because you got wolves close by. Call it wolves.
In the northern Rockies, where some perceive wolves as the biggest threat to livestock, the facts tell a different story. Wolves have been found responsible for less than 1% of the region's sheep and cattle losses. Far more dangerous are disease and bad weather. Even the domestic dog, man's best friend, is recently on record for killing five times as many livestock as their wild cousin, the wolf.
And so our view about wolves was that certainly they present some challenges for our operation, our sheep operation. We're running about 5,000 sheep over a very large area. But we also recognize that wolves are an important part of a fully functioning ecosystem. And so when we first found that we had lost sheep to wolves in 2002, our first instinct was, well, what is a way that we're going to be able to coexist with these animals?
I'm going to stop that one there. We have, in this last year, we had 27,305 sheep in our project area. We lost 4 in one incident to wolves, and we had 3 new wolf packs in the region. We've got over 500 photographs of wolves. We have no radio-collared wolves left in our entire county, but we've been using the trail cameras to be able to document wolf activity, and we have actually pictures of wolves and sheep in the same spot within 48 hours of each other. So a lot of these non-lethal tools are described in this booklet that I distributed to you. They are it's important to know which tool to use for the right situation. So things like livestock guarding dogs are extremely effective, but only if you're not using them in the springtime when wolves consider dogs to be a threat to their pups. And then livestock guarding dogs actually become an attractant to wolves. They're more likely to seek them out to try to destroy them so that they don't end up losing their pups to what they perceive as being a threat. So it's kind of like you have to spend some time a little bit assessing this as a wolf might assess it, and to be able to understand what kind of risks are out there and how to address those risks. Our project area is one of the largest in the country that I know of for testing these non-lethal tools. We're working with both cattle and sheep operations, and we're going into our 6th year this year. We're working with state, federal, tribal agencies, as well as all the local producers that are engaged in producing livestock in that area. So there are ways of working together to reduce livestock losses to wolves and to address them, but they're new to the landscape. Even in Idaho, they're still new. We're still dealing with the first generation of people who are learning to live with wolves again. And any time there's something new, I think it's in human nature to be afraid of it, to be concerned about it, to sometimes overreact to it. But if we can focus on trying to resolve these conflicts rather than just polarizing them, that's where our best use of our energy and resources are. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the last panel? No? Senator Olson, you look like you're getting...
You can
have the next to last question. Because I have a question, but go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No.
You're the chair.
Yeah. I'd like to ask my questions last, so wrap it up. Could you talk a little bit about, I had asked about private versus public lands, and I don't know if you had that experience in Idaho. Can you talk a little bit about that? And also, you mainly talked about sheep, so any experience you have with reducing depredation for cattle?
Our project area covers over 1,000 square miles right now, and most of it's on public land. Most of it's pretty rugged public land, not quite as rugged as some of the Hell's Canyon country. We were working on the ground in Wallowa County with the Range Rider program there, and that's a really tough area. What makes it doubly tough is that the ranchers there have to use dogs to herd cattle because they're in such just incredible terrain. It's very hard to collect cattle there, so they use the dogs. And unfortunately, that makes the cattle less afraid of canines. They're used to them. So it's going to take probably, you know, some level of education even within the cattle that not all canines are created equal, that they're not friend, you know, some of them are predators as well. And to develop more of a defense against them by being more more aggressive in protecting their own calves. We've seen that occur over time in Idaho, where the mother cattle are becoming a lot more defensive because they are learning that wolves are a new animal in the landscape. And so we're seeing losses actually reduced in areas where we have seen that defensiveness increase. And if you look at places like Alberta and British Columbia, they're losing far fewer calves to wolves in those areas than what we have in the Rockies, because those mother cattle have been used to having wolves on the landscape for a long time.
Senator, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you. It's quite interesting. You know, there was a guy named Pavlov that could train dogs. Do wolves get used to these noisemakers and the electric shock fences and all that stuff? And because they're really smart and they can figure out how to get around these things, can they be used to those things?
They can if you use them too much or under the wrong conditions. And I'm going to show you, this clip just came out from Washington State. We're barely, I don't think many people have seen this yet, but it's a wolf testing the phladry, and this wolf actually comes back and uses, comes back to this location. There's a calf or cow carcass inside this enclosure. He's been feeding off of this cow carcass for quite some time, and then they wrapped off the area in phladry, and it's not even electrified, it's just plain phladry. And he comes back 17 times, both during the night and day, and eventually he just decides to leave the whole area. Never penetrates this, even though it's just flattery hanging there. I mean, he jumps over the barbed wire fence on the left-hand side, but he never penetrates the flattery. And it's, I think it's convincing people that this stuff is a great tool, but you've got to use it. You've got to use it wisely. You can't just continue to expose wolves to it. You've got to mix them up, the tools that you're using with them. And you know, this is pretty exciting for us because this is the first time we've ever seen video, actually, of this wolf coming in, or any wolf, wild wolf, coming in and testing this stuff and not and showing that he just never, ever goes over the fence. So it's great for things like calving grounds. It's great for things like isolating carcasses. And I guess this wolf was about 80 miles north of there. I mean, this one, he's just standing there frustrated trying to figure out how the magpie's getting in, but he's not. So so you're trying to use their sense of risk, you know, what they consider to be new, scary. Doesn't look scary to us. Looks like it ought to be around a used car parking lot, right? But for them, it's something very intimidating. And then adding the electricity to it helps a lot because when a wolf does go to test something, they usually, like our dogs, because all of our dogs came from wolves, they'll often test it with their mouth. They'll come up and bite at it, and this stuff bites back when it's electrified. And we can put that anywhere, and we can send it, you know, up to the top of a mountain or whatever. But, you know, you have to use the right tool. And Rod was absolutely right. There's places that you cannot use this stuff. You have to rely on other tools. Things like increased human presence, carcass removal is a really big one. Wolves have an incredible sense of smell, and so they will go back to the same area where they fed off of these, you know, carcass piles, and they'll check those areas again and again, hoping they're going to get a free meal out of it. They're scavengers. So cleaning up carcasses is a really big deal, too. And we're doing that a lot with ranchers in Montana, helping them get those carcasses cleaned up so they don't attract wolves to their livestock.
Paula? Are any of you ranchers?
No. I'm not a rancher. I've lived in rural areas of Oregon and California for over 20 years. My husband and I had horses, and our neighbors were cattle, sheep, goats, bears, cougars, bobcats, rattlesnakes, tarantulas, and scorpions, depending on where we lived.
Ooh. Disgusting. The reason I asked that question is
that didn't say raccoons, by the way.
The reason I asked that question is you said, Dr. Weiss, you said that you did a survey and 90% of the 20,000 people that were surveyed are for more protection of wolves. So I just wondered if you knew what the logistics of that 20,000 were. Were they ranchers or were they just city folk to think the beef comes from in a package?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, I appreciate that question, particularly in line of your question previously about where your roast beef comes from.
Yeah.
I like someone that wants to know where their food comes from. So the survey actually was not a survey. The second that I was referring to were the public comments that were submitted by members of the public in response to the five-year review of the Wolf Plan. So these were more than 20,000 commenters coming in from all over Oregon. I don't think that there's a breakdown in terms of which of them may have been ranchers unless they specifically expressed that in their comment letters. And ODFNW may know that, but I can't tell you what percentage were ranchers. They were Oregonians.
Thank you. One last question. Mm-hmm. My only concern is the fact that, you know, the wolves are now introduced, and the ranchers who have for years and years and years not had to worry about cattle, and they work on slim margins. And when they lose cattle, it costs them, you know, a tremendous amount of money. I'm a businessman myself, and when things that cost me money exist, it bothers me, and I try to fix the problem. And it's difficult, I mean, because the problem becomes exacerbated when you need to hire more help to put out there to put these flag fences out and all these other techniques, or put people out in the field at night to try to scare the wolves off. I noticed in your testimony and your movie you had these folks that were out there. Well, were they paid by the ranchers?
Actually, they were not. We cost-shared a lot of the the expenses for our field crew. What our hope is that there are certain agencies that are right now very focused on doing lethal control of animals, particularly with wolves. But a lot of these non-lethal tools are a lot more cost-effective than the lethal control program itself. For example, in Washington State in this last year, killing one pack cost the state almost $80,000. It's one pack. We didn't spend that much money over the entire grazing season from June through October for our project on the ground, where we had five field techs out there working, rotating their work schedules so that they could cover that area for 7 days a week. So it's just a matter of knowing where to put your resources. And when the, you know, at this time when things are so limited, allowing so many resources to be wasted on lethal control when it's not needed, then it just seems like there's a better investment in protecting livestock to the get-go rather than going afterwards.
I would think, ma'am, that when you said where do you put your resources, when you're talking about that, you're actually talking about the resources of the cattlemen. And it, I look out for, I mean, the wolves are important, but I look out for the cattlemen because of the fact that their resources are finite. You know, there's the market fluctuations on their commodities. And when you go in and you take away a portion of their profit margin, it's difficult for them to, you know, smile and say that I don't have a problem with these guys, because it hurts their business. It hurts us in the industry, not in the industry, but to go to the grocery store, because it costs us more. It costs everybody more. But, you know, there's probably is a solution to separate the two. Whether we get there, it is going to be a different story.
I think Senator Hansel has a question.
Actually, his comment, along with Senator Bates said earlier, I have a lifelong buddy that is a retired ODOT engineer from Central Washington, and he's been going into the Selway in northern Idaho for 30 years, and he stopped going because he said the game's gone. So my friends said the same thing yours did.
I don't know.
So with that, we're going to wrap up because we're running short on time, but thank you very much for coming here today. I want to thank everybody who came today for the excellent informational hearing, and especially thank the folks from Idaho and Eastern Oregon who came all the way out here.
Long trip.
With that, I will close the informational hearing on the update on the wolf plan, and we are adjourned.
Thank you.